What we argue is that informal norms developed by these participatory institutions promoted by guerrillas combine, and this is very important, with the view that citizens should guarantee their needs independent of the state and elites, this may induce persistent changes in the relationship between communities in guerrilla areas and the states.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. El Salvador's brutal civil war was fought a generation ago, but what is its legacy? In war, normal economic activity, that declines, but it can be built back. Is there a longer-lasting damage, though, to institutions and trust? Mika Sviacci of Princeton is one of the authors of a paper that investigates this question for post-war El Salvador. And she joins me now. Mika, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim, so much for the interest on this paper.
I remember the civil war in El Salvador. I guess a lot of people wouldn't by now. So fill us in on some of the details, particularly who were the Farabundo Marchi National Liberation Front?
So it was a guerrilla group that was formed in 1980s by five left-wing guerrilla organizations. This is very important because It condensed five different groups. So in principle, this group started in urban areas, actually. But in 1981, after their first main offense that they did, and actually it failed to unseat the government, it generated two changes. First, it consolidated them as the main fighting force against the Salvadoran state. And second, a change in strategy as these guerrillas retreated to rural areas to regroup and prepare for a longer fight.
The U.S. government was describing them as communists, but I seem to remember the U.S. government described a lot of people as communists at that time. Was this fair? What were their aims?
I think that you are completely right, and that's why I said that it was composed by five groups, because The U.S. generally viewed the insurgency as communists, but this group was diverse. It composed five different groups. So, and importantly, they were not focused on indoctrinating peasants, but more interested on changing wealth inequality, undermine the power of state and traditional agricultural elites. For them, the main way to achieve this was the introduction of participatory institutions that promoted self-governance and self-sufficiency. One example is that these guerrilla commanders wanted the communities to be autonomous, not only from the state and repressive elites of that time, but also from guerrilla commanders itself. So this is very important. They wanted autonomy because these guerrillas didn't want the population under their control to be associated with guerrilla commanders and be attacked by the states. Do you see? So there is something here different.
How successful was this insurgency? How much of El Salvador did they end up controlling?
Actually, it was very successful when they did this change of strategy, as I told you before, at the beginning were mostly urban, then they changed to rural areas, and they had control almost half of the country, in particular of the north and the east of the country. They have a lot of control there of the population. And those were the places where they introduced the self-governance and displaced the state.
They challenged the state authority. They replaced the state authority, as you say, but if those state institutions are not working in those areas, what institutions are replacing them?
Yes, the main way they replaced the state was the establishment of participatory institutions that allow these peasants and citizens to self-governance and to provide public goods. There is a lot of qualitative evidence that guerrillas promoted autonomous community-based organizations to respond to health, education, and economic demands. And importantly, the guerrillas conceived these areas under their control as spaces that where civilians could satisfy their need and work collectively to solve these problems independently of the state, the elites, and also from the military command. For example, I will give you an example to promote self-sufficiency. These guerrillas assisted in forming autonomous local councils. First, they have something called poderes populares locales, like popular community powers. And later, they have these dual powers, which they call poderes de doble cara, which was basically why they call poderes of doble cara, because you have the commander that was under the control, but then you also have the autonomy of the citizens to solve these public goods problems that they have in their daily life. So these new governing institutions administered and organized by the local population, not by the commanders of the FMLN. So the main purpose was to procure public goods and solve this affecting any issues that were affecting the community. They existed in various forms, no? And they all more or less fostered democratic activity by the residents. According to qualitative evidence, these citizens participated in their own government and largely viewed these powers as legitimate. Some group events have popular assemblies. Some others also held elections for the position. So it was pretty democratic and it had the support of the populations because of this of the autonomy. So it was not that the guerrilla was imposing something to the population.
So if I'm living in one of these rural areas of El Salvador at the time that comes under the control of the guerrillas, how does my day-to-day life change? It sounds like it changes quite a lot.
The first thing that changed for you is that for the first time, you are able to govern yourself and gain autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
The FMLN supported these base organizations, but there was a way to organize by myself independently of the state and also the elites that before, agricultural elites that maybe I was working before. So this meant also that these residents, since they have the autonomy, they did not fear to be labeled insurgents. In general, by that time, of the government, everyone that was a peasant for the state, you were an insurgent. The fact that you were there and you have this autonomy, you were not targeted by the state. You were not attacked. First, you have the protection of the FMLN. And also, since you have this autonomy to self-government, also kind of separate you from the FMLN commanders, from these guerrilla commanders.
Mm-hmm.
So you gain two things here, how to self-govern, how to have this self-sufficiency, not only to govern, but also economically, because you learn how to produce subsistence crops and everything. And also, you were not targeted by the state, because you were dissociated from these FMLN commanders. You see that this very different than there is here.
Yes. Now, this war is historical at this point. How did the war end? When did it end?
So the story of this war is that since 1985, the war entered a stalemate phase where nobody was winning more or less territory. And when they started negotiation in 1989, which ended in 1992 after 2 years of this peace process and where you were having this stalemate phase where nobody was winning more territory,
mm-hmm.
they decided to sign this Acuerdos de Chapultepec, where the key of that agreement was that the guerrillas, the FMLN, became transitioned to be a political party and leave all the arms. And the state, what the state committed to do some national reforms, for example, a reform in the judicial system, a defense of human rights, and as well as a creation of the national police that they didn't have to replace the existing National Guard. So that's how it ended. The FMLN, the guerrilla commanders and their members, they became a political party, and the state committed to do these reforms.
But at the end of all of this, these areas that had been self-governing, they nominally at least come back under the control of the state.
So yes, when this ended in 1982, all these areas, they were now fully controlled by the state by the end of the war. And actually, we see this in the data because we have data, for instance, on public schools, state presence, police presence, and you don't see any difference on state presence in the post period. And another thing that is very important with this conflict is, unlike other conflicts where there were dissidents, for instance, you could think today of the FARC, no, that they said mm-hmm. there is a peace agreement, but there are dissidents. Here, there were no dissidents, not that many, from the FMLN. And this is mainly because the guerrilla commanders and leaders and members, they all transitioned to be a political party, and that's why the conflict was fully over.
Guerrillas have begun to patch together the areas under their control. Some spokesmen go so far as to say guerrillas hold 30 to 40% of the country. Guerrillas have put a priority on occupying towns as well as hilltops. In Potosí, only a few miles from government positions to the south, guerrillas turned up on market day to talk with villagers.
¡Viva la brigada, Rafael Artes habla!
Okay, Mika, so let's look at your research now. You've compared the outcomes for these regions that were under guerrilla control to those in the rest of El Salvador. Well, the first thing that you have to do is to know which regions were which. Often when you have conflicts like this, it's very hard to know. How did you know exactly which areas were under guerrilla control?
So this is actually a very important question. As part of the peace talks, a detailed map of the areas was needed to define which areas were under dispute, which areas needed more investment. Something that we talk about is that areas that were under the control of guerrillas, no? Then also areas that were under control of the state, but there were also some areas in between that they were under disputes. And those are potentially the ones that you have more battles, more conflicts, more deaths, and you will need more investment in those areas. So they needed to be an agreement about which were the areas under dispute, which were the areas under the control of guerrillas, and which were the areas under the state. And this is what was done in the peace agreement. So the definitions of these areas actually was relatively easy because, as I told you before, after 1985, they were entered this stalemate phase where nobody was winning more territory or not. So that's how they could agree on this map. And on the top of everything, still, we validate this map. So something that we did in the paper is we did a lot of focus groups with ex-commanders, and they both validated this map from both sides.
And you're looking at different outcomes for people who lived in different parts of El Salvador. There's a lot of potential outcomes you could have looked at. Which ones did you decide to measure?
To measure the impact, the first thing we wanted to know, what were the impacts in economic development? And here what we use is administrative data from the census in 2011, which has data on years of education and also assets, which allow us to construct a wealth index per household. And we complement this also with satellite light data and as well as household surveys where there is reported income, and also to understand the mechanism behind what is it about this rebel governance or governance of guerrillas that affects development. We also evaluate on measures of trust, social capital, and political participation.
This is, on one hand, an amazing natural experiment, but I would have thought that initially the regions that became occupied by the guerrillas might have had a different history. They might have been poorer, for example. Therefore, they had more sympathy for the guerrillas. They might have had different prospects for growth. They might have been areas in which the government was particularly distrusted. Is there a difference?
No, and actually we thought the same as you when we started this project. We thought, okay, these guerrillas, the final aim was to reduce this wealth inequality, so maybe they target places on the first place that were more unequal. And actually, at baseline, we don't see that these characteristics change. So how we do it is that we have, as a proxy of this inequality, we had a land reform in 1980s. So we exploit that because exposure to that land reform can be a proxy of how unequal was that place and how unhappy people were there, and therefore would mean more sympathizers to these guerrillas. And actually, we see that there are no difference on exposure to this land reform across this border. Another proxy that we use for guerrilla supporters at baseline is the location of community-based churches, which were known by that time to support guerrillas. And we do not see any differences at baseline. The only significant difference that we observe here is a small discontinuity in altitude, which is very consistent with qualitative evidence and findings from our interviews with former combatants from the FMLN, which says that the territories, the boundaries, were primarily defined by war strategies. In particular, rebel territories included strategic locations that offer this topographic advantage against the enemy and were not correlated with economic conditions.
Now, to compare the outcomes for adjacent or similar areas, you would probably need quite precise measures of economic activity. Where do you get that precision from? What measure do you rely on most?
So we relied a lot on the census tract data. So the census in 2007 has data at the census tract level, which is, just to give you an example, like if it would be a community, a neighborhood, it's very little. This is very fine data. And there where we get information of years of education and wealth. And also we have the satellite light data, which is also at a fine level. The nice with that data is that you can observe the changes since 1992. Since the agreement, you can start seeing how the past diverge or not. The other data that we use is our own survey that we did in these areas to understand to households that are located in either side of the boundaries, to understand how social capital change, how norms, how distrust changes in these locations.
So over four decades, you're making this measurement. Do you still detect a difference in economic development across these boundaries?
So yes, and this is what it was the most surprising, is that it had large and negative persistence. So the persistence is what is more surprising, because almost 20 years after the end of the guerrilla government and the return of the formal state, that we know that they came back to these locations, you see that these areas still have less nightlight luminosity, lower human capital, worse wealth outcomes than individuals that live just 2 kilometers away. Moreover, you see that this divergence starts in 1992, as I was saying, and the same with years of schooling. We can evaluate years of schooling in 2007, then 2018, in 2022 with our own surveys, and still we find negative effects. And what it is more surprising is that we find negative effects on education for cohorts that started their education after the territorial control ended. So there are these persistent effects.
And these effects are large enough to be economically significant.
Yes, for you to have an idea, when you use the light density data, this is about 18% lower night light density luminosity, which is equivalent to a 5% lower GDP. Mm-hmm. Then this is equivalent in terms of years of education, is 0.4 fewer years of education. So these are big differences.
Still on the drawing board for towns under rebel control are the sweeping changes in land ownership and political participation promised by the guerrillas. An official in the mayor's office explains the biggest difference, now the guerrillas are in control, is there is less repression.
Above all, there is more order within the population. And we are working, well, more freely.
Mika, there's a lot of research that shows that even a few years after a war, affected areas tend to catch up fairly quickly. You're measuring, what is it, 3-4 decades after the war, and you still see these regions are yet to catch up. Was this a big surprise for you?
Yes, you're right. While some research shows convergence, our research shows that if you look at these outcomes at a micro level, the aggregate trend may be missing the divergence at a more local level due to the territorial control of rebels in some particular places that generated these structural social and economic changes that persist today, potentially mainly, and here's our hypothesis, to a change in social norms. So let me give you a bit more of details about this. Despite the fact, as I told you, that state regained these areas, what we argue is that informal norms developed by these participatory institutions promoted by guerrillas, combined, and this is very important, with the view that citizens should guarantee their needs independent of the state and elites, this may induce persistent changes in the relationship between communities in guerrilla areas and the states. We know that rebels usually create these institutions that can promote cooperation. We have seen it in many contexts. Yet here, what we argue is that these norms of self-governance can crowd out the role of the post-conflict state if they are developed to avoid dependence of political and economic elites, no? Impeding this development of trust and engagement with post-war government in the long run. Here, the key is to understand the long-run negative effects, to understand this long negative that we see in economic outcomes, is this self-governance part, which was developed as an alternative of the state. Okay? So the fact that the rebel governance is generally promoted as a substitute of the state is particularly important to understand the negative consequence, since it reduced cooperation with the government in the post-conflict period due to these enduring norms of distrust.
I see. So it wasn't one set of norms were replaced by another imposed set. Because they were self-generated, that is why they are so persistent?
Yes, exactly.
Today, let's imagine, say you and I are citizens of two adjacent regions in El Salvador, and one had been under the guerrilla control, one had not been. How different would our lives be?
So they would be very different. If I live in guerrilla areas, now I will have less income, less years of education, less wealth than you. Also, I will have less engagement with the state, less trust towards them. But on the other hand, I will have more social capital than you. I will trust much more my neighbors. And also, I will have less exposure, and this is something that we observe, to criminal organizations.
So does this help to explain why those economic differences still exist? Because if you could just look 2 kilometers in one direction and see that other people were rich and have more, richer and have more schooling, as an economist, you would think there would be an incentive
to move.
Yeah.
To move. So we don't see anything of that, of migration, even temporary, no? Because they don't need even to move, but they could go work there and then come back. So we don't see that. And this is because, on the one hand, in general, norms are difficult to change, no? You know that once you have a norm of distrust, it's difficult to change. There is research also showing that sometimes there is a mismatch between historical social norms that could have been optimal during guerrilla control and the best action given the current environment, no? Mm-hmm. In this case, as I said, while distrust towards the state may have been optimal behavior during guerrilla control areas, given the historical repression of the state and elites, such distrust afterwards may have been suboptimal because the state have changed and those elites were gone. However, on the other hand, while in terms of income, guerrillas had a negative effect, there are also positive effects that we observe, like an increase in social capital, self-sufficient trust within the community. And this social capital can also have positive spillovers on crime. For example, as I said, we find some evidence that in formerly guerrilla areas, there is less gang activity. Also, in my previous work, I see that children that grew up in these areas, in formerly guerrilla areas, are less likely to be involved with gangs, since in these areas there is more social capital.
How does this influence government policy in these regions? Does it mean that its policies are less effective?
Yes, and this has a very big effect. And this is where, like, the effects are even larger, no? Because you have this effect in income that can come from this distrust. And how is that it's being affected? It's because this distrust, this engagement, affect government capacity in policy, no? Mm-hmm. We know from existing research that when citizens distrust, it is difficult for the state to find out the preference or need of these citizens. Citizens may fail to communicate their needs if they don't believe in that politician will respond. And this is engagement could prevent the government from providing public goods effectively. Mm-hmm. They may provide, but maybe know what they want. At the same time, we know that there is research showing that less trust in state institutions can also decrease the demand for public services, since citizens do not see this government as legitimate or capable, no? In the context of El Salvador, we actually find some evidence of these channels. We find that citizens in former guerrilla areas, today they report lower access and utilization of public services and are less likely to pay taxes. This is very surprising because despite the fact that since 1995 we see more public investment in the same services where they are reporting lower access. They constructed schools and also no difference in state building hospitals, but still you have this mismatch.
This was one of many civil conflicts in Latin America around that time and in Asia as well. We still see many today, sub-Saharan Africa in particular. Is this legacy of civil war something that we might apply to development for those regions, or is this something unique to what happened in El Salvador?
We think that it's common in many contexts that non-state actors, armed actors, frequently establish this durable territorial control during conflicts. We have seen this with insurgencies that establish autonomous governing authorities in other places like Philippines with a new People's Army, which established local committees in areas under their control. Also with the Maoist insurgency in Nepal, which organized civilians under a parallel government in vast territories under their control. Also in Myanmar, also in Uganda, you see this self-government in parallel of the state. So I think that our results can externalize to this context. Also in Latin America, of course, there are different types of rebel governance, no? This one is the particularity that is self-government and in parallel of the state, like replacing the state. But also in Latin America, we have seen throughout the history many rebel groups that have established institutions to regulate civilian life in other different ways. In Colombia, we have it with the FARC that controlled many remote areas before the signing of the peace agreement in 2016, the same with Shining Path. And like this, I can give you other well-documented examples of armed actors who have engaged in local governments in the DRC, in Liberia, India.
If you're a policymaker tasked with post-conflict recovery in a region that's had this kind of conflict, is there anything that we can learn from this to improve their effectiveness? Or also, bearing in mind what you've said about levels of social capital, are there some areas where they should maybe not get involved?
Here is the most difficult question, no? Because
yes.
We know that changing norms is difficult, but we believe it's key in this area to regain the trust of citizens by meaningful presence of state. Not just a state investment, but maybe approaching individuals, organizing political meetings with individuals to understand the needs of their communities, provide us information about what the state can do or did. Moreover, in the case of El Salvador, what they could do is to take advantage of the fact that they already have more social capital to build trust. If one social leader from these areas can trust the state, that can spill over to other ones in the community. Another approach could be potentially try to include the social leaders of these areas in the political process. We know that after the Civil War, the guerrillas became a political party, but this was for the commanders and members, but not for the citizens. And this does not necessarily reflect the preference of people in these areas that were controlled by guerrillas. And actually, this is very interesting because one result that we see in the paper is that no matter the ideology of the government in the post-conflict, you don't see a reversion of the effects, which tells you about these differences.
It is a remarkable investigation into what happens after a conflict, the lasting effects, the good and the bad. Thank you very much for talking about it today.
No, thank you so much, Tim. I enjoy a lot talking to you.
The paper is called Rebel Governance and Development, The Persistent Effects of Distrust in El Salvador. And the authors are Antonella Bandiera, Lelis Dinarte Diaz, Juan Miguel Jimenez, Sandra Rojo, and Mika. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you also find articles about the papers we feature.